Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
The shocking story of Jenny Bellstar.
She actually murdered my sister in front of me.
She was sent to a home.
And they sent you back home.
To be abused again.
But life has a way of surprising us. Jenny's friend invited her to a recording studio. She wasn't supposed to sing.
I said, I told you I couldn't sing. She said, actually, you can.
And that was the start of her Bellstar career.
Every single record label came down to see us.
When it was over, Jenny had gone to Miami to visit and stay with a friend. And then one day, she heard her own record.
And the people that were talking over it were some Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman.
But when she came back to Britain, tragedy struck again.
He took his own life. This wasn't for me anymore. I have been a lost soul. It's what you do with the experiences of life that you have that will make you the butterfly that you become in the future.
A story of incredible highs and lows. So here it is. And don't forget, subscribe to this channel.
Jenny Matthias, Jenny Bellstar, welcome. Listen, I really was fascinated, gripped, and I don't know. I mean, your book brought up so many emotions and it was wonderful. It's called Surviving the Storm, How to Embrace Your Pain and Grow Through Adversity. It's, in a nutshell, it's a story of your life, but put in a way that is like a self-help book for people, something that could help people change their own lives, which is wonderful. Now, I want to come to that later, and I want to come later to a particular sentence that stuck with me after I read the book, and that was that you believe you chose your mother as a parent. Now, I'd like to put that out there for people to just take in now before we talk about your story, because I really want to know what that sentence really means to you.
I feel really bad that I'm wearing my hat, but the windows are wide open. I came in here, I was talking to my friend, funny enough, the guitarist from Madness, he's a good friend of mine, and we were talking and talking. I just said, I couldn't sit here with this guy, I've let him down before, I can't do it again. And of course, all the windows are still open, it's freezing cold here, and on top of that, but I've been for the last goodness knows how long trying to get into the Zoom. I couldn't get into the Zoom. So I'm not taking my hat off because it's such a bad hair day. I just thought, oh, I ain't doing that.
Okay. Well, I want to take you to your childhood. And it sounds very hard to go to jump to this straight away. But you had a childhood that was fraught with violence. What are your early memories of your childhood?
Well, my first was my mother. She actually murdered my sister in front of me. And that's the earliest memory I have. And then, of course, something like that, it's very, very traumatic. I was three.
How does a three-year-old take that in? Do you actually remember? Do you actually know? You said it's your earliest memory.
No, it must, when you go through trauma, Steve, it's a feeling that never leaves you. And you know that there's something really strange that has happened in your lifetime that you're able to, things trigger, things will trigger that emotion. One of the things that triggered that emotion later on in my life was the fact that my brother, my younger brother, the reason why my mother was triggered like that, by the way, was that she was suffering that thing that you suffer when you've had a child. Was it postnatal depression? I think it was. I think that's what the deal was. And my sister, she had a very high-pitched screaming voice. So she was very, very high-pitched. And my mother couldn't take it on those moments where she was feeling in that way. Now, of course, I didn't understand that at the time because I was very young and I just didn't understand that sort of thing at that time. So that was one of the things that she did. And just through this moment of madness, she put the pillow over my sister's face, strangled her, And the next thing you know, she's dead.
I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about the consequences for you in your life, but just out of interest, what were the consequences for your mother of that action?
Well, you have to understand that my mother and my father, my mother's Irish and my father's Jamaican. This was the 50s. And they didn't care. And my mother was a very attractive woman. And she could put anybody around her little finger, and that's exactly what she did. And then, and she just got away with it. And that's fine. That's fine, because it's just fine. You know, it's fine. I'm not bitter about that. Why, you know, I for whatever reason, when you get older in life, Steve, you become a lot more like philosophical about things, and you realize that there's a bigger thing going on here.
When did you realize that the experience you were having wasn't normal?
Good question. Because as a child, you don't know, you don't think like that. You don't think, you're just going from A to B to wherever. And I was in I think we went to a holding place, which I've got no idea anything about that. But we then went on to a convent. And it was the convent that made me realize there's something wrong here. I shouldn't be here with all these nuns and these crazy people. And then I then moved on to a children's home. And the children's home was an incredible experience, and possibly the savior of my life. And although it was kind of religious and everything else, and we fell into that kind of category. The most important part was we had stability, which is something I would never have had I been with my mother. And my mother was damaged goods as a child, and so I understood later on why she was the way she was. And so what I would say about the children's home was the stability that we never had when we were with my mother, all the normality of it all. And when you're in a children's home, you get, everyone's so lovely to you because they think you're an orphan, and you are. And you think you're all of these things. And then the social services come in and decide, right, it's time for you to go back.
And they sent you back home to your
and
mother.
And they sent me back home to be abused again. And because I was the oldest child, of course, I would, this would be, everything would be on me. And by that time, my mother had had other children, and there were seven children, I think it was, she had, which actually originally she'd had nine. And then what, the first one died, which is the older one. And then there was me, and then there was Elaine. Elaine was the one she killed in front of me. But I have a funny feeling that she killed the other one before me. But that I can't say that because I wasn't born, but I have that feeling because that's the kind of woman she was.
I mean, you mentioned this terrible physical abuse, but there was also verbal abuse. Your mother used to say...
The mental.
I hate you, you are ugly.
Mm-hmm. Are you reading the poem from that? Are you? Yeah. Is that the bit you're getting out of the... Yeah. You've got to turn these things into something positive, don't you? You know, these experiences. Yes, she did, every day. She would say that quite often. And she'd say that I'd never have a boyfriend. And she'd also say that no one would listen to a word I said. And so I grew up with a very low self-esteem. But I don't have it now. And because I've come out the other side, I'm able to show people how they too can become the alchemists of their own life, you know? So that's what that book's about. You know, I wrote that book in the gym. I wrote it on the treadmill, the whole book. I wrote the thing on the treadmill. And you know what it's like when you're on a treadmill. I don't know if you've done that, but you're on a treadmill. It's so boring. It's just so boring. And I always walk around with a journal because I'm a writer. That's what I do. And so I just you know, and I was writing notes, and I'd come back, and you know, and every day I would do that, and it was like near on like 6 months or something. And then the next thing you know, something pops into my head, because I'm very much into intuition, and says, you got a book there. And I thought, did I hear that? So I have a book here. And sure enough, I turned it into a book, and it grew legs. Next thing you know, I'm doing a book launch. Place was rammed. And then from that, I then started to write community projects, because that was like, you know, that there was the book. What else could I do with the book? Well, you could go out and do the events for the book. And now I've become the ambassador for many places. And one of them, it was for people that had been abused in their lifetime. And my job on this earth, I honestly think, and believe, is that I am here to offer guidance through my experiences. And I've come out the other side of, you know, I've lived to tell the tale. And my job is to show others how they too can. I've got a project called Show and Grow, and it's showing people how to grow through adversity. So, and the people like it. They really, really like it. I get on really well with. I went for the hardest one. I was an ambassador for some people that have been sexually abused, and as children, and still in their adult minds. They keep going round and round and round back to that where they were, and it never leaves them. And my job is to show them how they can use that as a tool in which to help themselves and then go on to help others. And so if you're looking at the negative, which is what's happened to them, and it's the thing that's killing them, and it's in their head all the time, you know, they don't often see the positive. But my job is to show them the positive.
Trauma has an impact on your body. You hold the trauma within your body, and it can develop into diseases, or it can have an impact on you later in life because you're holding it in there. So in that sense, with what has happened to you, especially from your childhood, mm-hmm. how do you think trauma impacted your body, and how did you deal with that aspect of it?
Self-medicated, I'd imagine, because all the things that happened afterwards, then I, you know, then I joined a band, and that was just fell in my lap, and then I became a pop star, and that fell in my lap, and then you're in that environment back in the 80s when, you know, cocaine and heroin was all, you know, free and this and that, and then so I think for about 8 years I self-medicated. And then I realized that this wasn't for me anymore. And I'd have to come off of this. And just like everything else in my life, this fell on my lap. When I chose to actually give up, I didn't choose to go to any of these places. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it wasn't for me. Each to their own. I'm kind of private in that way. And I didn't want to go to a place where the, you know, I'm talking in a group of people about my problems. This and that. I couldn't do it. So I had to do it myself. So I had to go kind of cold turkey. And then I went on a spiritual kind of quest, into some kind of Buddhist center, and that was great. And I came back, and I just realized, you know, by then I was kind of cleaning my act up. And then a few days after I came back, you know, I must have been running on that energy, because I think energy has got a lot to do with the things that happen within your life. And I got a phone call from my sister-in-law. She said, Jenny, do you know, you know, what the drug czar is talking about? And I said, no, what's the bloody drug czar? And then she said, well, they are desperate to get people in that have been through the drug thing, come out the other side and do projects with the children. Well, I'm a creative. So for me, that was just too easy. And I had nothing to do because I was still kind of trying to heal myself and everything else. So I wrote a project, a two-hour project that would be useful for schools or anything. And also, I like write a lot of poetry. A lot of my poetry at that particular time was all about drugs because I've been involved in it and the perils of drug abuse and this, that, the other. Anyway, one day, and this is after I'd written the project, right? One day I was doing a cabaret thing with a good friend of mine and I had done these poems in this cabaret thing. And there was a teacher in the audience, unbeknownst to me. So the next thing you know, I am in that school teaching drug awareness. And then it just escalated from there. I started teaching, you know, got really into the community vibe and loved it. Became a community champion. You know, I'm still working within the community. Now we feed the homeless. And they've got problems themselves. You know, a lot of people that have gone on the wayside is usually through drugs. And so, you know, we give them free food and everything else. And yeah, I wish I wasn't wearing this hat, but it's too late now, guys. I'm not taking it off. Anyway, in the meantime, I'm still cold because the window's open, but it's all right. I'm having a nice hot cup of tea.
Make sure you stay to the end of this interview when Jenny talks about how we all have parallel lives. And don't forget, please subscribe.
A friend that I'd met in the pub, hardly knew her, so she couldn't really admit she wasn't that much of a friend, but I thought, well, you know, kind of acquaintance thing. And she said, Jenny, I'm going to do a single. I'm going to do some music. And I said, I didn't know you could sing. And she said, well, can you give me your support? Now, at that time, I had laryngitis. And I said to her, oh, it's not really for me. She said, Jen, she said, I need the company. I said, okay. I said, all right, I'll come with you. So I went there and there were singers in there and it was in Waterloo. And I think the guy's name was Ian. He was a really lovely guy. And I was in the console with him. Yeah, this thing whilst they, you know, and I was watching people going in and out and doing the singing and didn't think anything other than I'm just there to support my friend. Anyway, the guy turned around and says to me, Jenny, he said, why don't you give it a go? I said, oh, no, I don't do that. I don't sing. No, it's not, that's not for me. Not interested. And he said, well, you said you've got a great speaking voice. Why don't you try it? So I said, all right, then I'll try. You know, he said, you see what we've been doing. So I went in there, did the backing vocals, came back in. He said, I said, I told you I couldn't sing. He said, oh, no. He said, actually, you can. And so he got rid of the two lead singers. They went home. Now, I know nothing about studios and I know nothing about anything, right? And then he said, why don't you give this a try? And so I looked around and then it dawned on me. I'm like, hold on a minute. I didn't even want to come here. I'm supposed to be supporting my friend. This guy's asking me now to do the lead vocal. I'm not feeling too good about this, you know? So then it's like, oh, anyway, I did it. And back in those days, it was cassettes. So he put the music on the cassette. He said to me, this is a brilliant guy. Would you come back and do it again? And I said, yeah, go on then. Because I didn't know. I didn't understand. And so I went home. I never saw that girl again, by the way. I never saw her again when I come to think about it. Now I'm speaking to her. I'm thinking, whatever happened to her? Anyway, so then I kid you not, that night I went home and I said to the then boyfriend, Paul Jenkins, I said, you'll never guess what I've done today. I threw the cassette at him. He played it. He said, I didn't know you could sing. So I said, nor did I. I said, somebody said they told me I could sing. So anyway, I kid you not, that's how it happened. The following day, he gets a phone call from his ex-girlfriend, Sarah Jane Owen, and he says, she says, Paul, this is a real long shot, but we're looking for a singer. We've just lost Rhoda, our singer, from the Body Snatchers. And he said, I can't believe you just called me. He said, she's sitting right next to me. So she said, what do you mean? He says, my new girlfriend, she can sing. You want to hear her? And then she's like, what does she look like? Now, back in those days, I had an afro. I used to wear frilly shirts and all this kind of stuff. She says, I know her. I know she. I sing it down Gaz's Rockin' Blues. Now, I don't know if you know who Gaz is, but Gaz was a good friend of mine. And he's Gaz Mayo. He's John Mayo's son. And I was a big fan of John Mayo's when I was a teenager. Anyway, so Gaz was my friend. And I used to always go down to the club. And I used to always dress up. So with the Body Snatchers, they love image. And if you've got half an image there, they don't care if you can't sing too much, but they want it then. Anyway, so they said, send her down. Well, I'd never been to an audition in my life. And I have to say, I forgot to say to you in the studio, the song that they were doing was Aiko.
So there you are. You've got, your boyfriend at the time manages somehow to connect you because the Body Snatchers have got rid of the singer and they're looking for another singer, and then they form the Bell Stars. So this initial period for you, how exciting was that?
How exciting was it? I suppose it was, because I'd never done anything quite like it before. And the thing is, with me, I used to just like go with the flow. I mean, I'd always been like that kind of person, go with the flow, go, what can I do? Just go with the flow. And at first, you see, you have to understand, Steve, I had very low self-esteem. My mother told me I was ugly. I don't look too hot with this hat on, by the way, but anyway, never mind. It's like the next time, oh, I'm so sorry, Steve. If there's ever a next time, I promise you, I'll do my own. Anyway, so she told me I was ugly. No one would ever listen to me, right? And there was another one. I can't remember what it was. I'll never have a boyfriend. So no one would be ever interested in me. And she lied about all of them. Because now I'm playing on the TV. Everyone's listening to me on the radio. I'm out there and I'm conversing in between the tracks. But that took time. Because it was inbuilt in my head that I was all these things, and how dare I go out there and assume that I'm anything different than that. And so when I, in fact, on my first audition, I didn't even sing to the band. I had to sing in front of the wall because I was too shy.
I want to tell you something about my life, because my mother told me, well, first of all, my father didn't want a third child, like a third son. And I was the third son. He was having an affairs and so on. And he didn't have a lot to do with me. And I believe I ended up on MTV later because it was the compensation. I was looking for love from the whole world, as it were.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not real. Do you know what I mean? I think I got the drive from that moment to be successful. Somehow within me, there was a drive for this compensation. When I got the compensation, it wasn't compensation, it was a lie. And I just wondered whether you can really see that possibly your drive came from this terrible events in your childhood. And then suddenly you're starting to get known, you're starting to do what everyone wanted to be in that era. Everyone wanted to be a pop star, have some attention, be like, I don't know, on Top of the Pops, whatever. And in effect, though, it's actually still not making you happy. So despite, you saying what your mother said, all these negative things that you're ugly, you'll never have a boyfriend and all this stuff. And then suddenly you are successful and you should have been able to take that on board. Is this really the case that actually the trauma is deeper than the compensation?
That's a very good question.
A bit long.
Long, but I mean, a question like that would only come from someone that has been there in some form or other. So I'd imagine it's probably one of the reasons why I've never had a question like that before. I think it's both, I think you don't get over that trauma until other things happen. And for me, but you know what, Steve, I think everyone's different, honey. For me, it was also my mother was a self-abuser as well. So it's part of the course, really, isn't it? So, she smoked weed, which is fine. Then she'd take these tablets, and then she'd be uppers and downers and sideways and this. And that was like a mood thing for her, So, I used to walk on eggshells every single day because I didn't know what to expect, Would I get the kind of baseball bat at the back of the head? Would I get, punched in the face where the blood's going down on the bath? All of those kind of things, But I've survived it. A bit crazy, I know, but survived it. But then when you're going through life, you just, I mean, I've always been one to go with the flow, go with the flow. And you're just wandering around in life, not realizing how traumatized you really are and how that you've not dealt with that. And so then, of course, I'm now in an environment where I'm surrounded by drugs. Not everybody that has had a traumatic life is going to go down that road. I possibly did, because I was probably something that I've seen my mother do. I had all that kind of stuff around me. So that wasn't an unusual thing, just to go, oh, you know, take a drug here, take a drug there. Then it gets worse when you start having the habit. But I'd imagine possibly the reason for taking them in the first place was escapism. And what do drugs usually do? Oh, they make you feel great, you know. Well, I probably don't today, but the ones that we had were fantastic. And so they did the job. But then the drugs stop working when you become addicted. And then it's a whole different ballgame of like the self-medication is now the desperation to keep getting that hit and getting that hit. And you never, ever get that hit. So anybody want to take drugs, let me tell you from now, don't do it. It's just not worth it. But in the meantime, so then there was a whole thing where I had to come off, and then you're running around with the wrong people and everything else. Until one day I went, boom, I know I'm going to die. I just know it. And I looked in the mirror, and it's almost like my reflection saying, you know, Jen, this isn't what you were here for. You know, you're here for greater things. And I just thought, well, you know, right, it's time. And so I did. And it took me quite a few months. And then you're not over that mentally. But then another thing that fell on my lap, which is the thing I told you about, you know, the finding out about the drug czar and everything else. But it was my spirit within me that really, you know, just went for it. Like, you know, the old jolly hockey sticks. Oh, I could do that. And the reason why I could do that was because I'd been a creative artist. By the way, Steve, I'd already done the band by then, finished that, and there was a great, great, massive gap. And what I did was, you know, I hang out with some of the druggy pop stars. I won't say who they are. In fact, they're all dead. In fact, actually, most of them are dead. So maybe I can say it, but I don't want to do that. You know, it's just we were buddies. You know, we're all buddies. And God, how do I stay alive? I've got no idea. Anyway, there was a reason for it, and that reason was possibly the book, and to be able to, you know, show people that there is life after this. And you know, I have some friends that have been on through the drug thing, and they're bitter about the way they, you know, or they're upset about having taken it. And I'm like, great, you know, that was one part of my life. I did it for a reason. I did it to help a whole pile of kids. I mean, the stuff that I've had along the way, and that I've been able to assist people in some way or other, is by sharing this knowledge and inspiring them to walk a different path. My thing is always about growth. It's not about stagnation. It's always about, how can you grow? Well, you can't grow with drugs. It's very, very simple. You know, I found a way to do it because I found an outlet. That outlet is like, I'm using that past experience in order to be able to help not myself, not just myself, but the masses. So during the course of my writing, those particular projects was quite cathartic for me. It was a very cathartic journey, but it was also so much fun. And if you've read the book, which, by the way, I have to say thank you so much. Thank you for the review and the live review for it, because I've had many people that said they've really enjoyed the book, you know. So, and it's always people that have been through some form of trauma. So that really, that grabs my soul and grabs my heart. It's something I can really resonate with. But, you know, at the time of writing it, you know, I knew within my soul and my heart that this was the right thing to do. And Steve, you know, right? You know, because things happen. Shit starts to happen. you get ideas in your head. And if you've read that book, which I know that you have, you got to the part where you got to intuition. I gave intuition like a chapter. You know, intuition is my best friend, is my guide. It's the being out inside or outside of me or whatever that comes and gives me my lyrics. You know, it's the being that before I do anything in the day, before I have a cup of tea or anything that I talk to. And even if it's for 5 minutes, I like to do 30 minutes, but sometimes it's like, oh shit, I'm late. Okay, let's go. You know, and we have a conversation together. And people probably think, I'm as mad as a box of frogs, a good friend of mine says to me. Yeah, Jen, you're as mad as a box of frogs. Fine, I don't care. That it works for me, you know, it works for me. And I do everything with intuition in mind. You know, we have great conversations together.
I want to get back to the Bell Stars, just talk about the music a second, because, okay, so you start with the Bell Stars and then you somehow get to Stiff Records. Really cool record company at the time.
The best.
Credible, everything. So there's an effectively, I don't know whether you like this term, but effectively a girl group. Mm-hmm. Being taken mm-hmm. by
they were before. You see, I knew nothing about music. You have to remember this. So when we were in the Bell Stars, they'd already been the Body Snatchers. So there was some kind of little hype about them and everything else. But when we turned into the Bell Stars, and also remember the environment was changing from ska to now the new romantic scene. So we've gone from that. I came in on the cusp, and so. In between that, you had the new wave, new romantics, pop, all that kind of stuff, and we went on the kind of ska pop thing because they'd already been the reggae kind of thing. So we did this pop thing, and I think Dave Robinson, the person that owned Stiff Records at the time, is this canny Irishman. He took on Madness. Well, I think he must have assumed, because the girls were a ska band, the Body Snatchers, and then of course they didn't defunct, they just morphed into the Bell Stars, that we were going to be the female version of Madness. Well, we weren't, of course, but that's not the point. But here's the deal. So it came to the point where we'd now have to do a gig. And it was one of those gigs back in those days. I don't know if they do it now, but I don't think they do. But it was always like the pomp and circumstance with bands. Oh, the new band is out here. There's a hype on this band. Well, we were the one that were hype. And of course, it was seven women. And the seven women played their own six women played their own instruments. I just sang. And wrote their own songs and everything else. And then we had a gig in Dingwalls, Camden Town. Camden Town. And so what happened was every single record label came down to see us. Everyone. And this is when Dingwalls was at its height. It was a fantastic venue. And we played and everybody courted us. And who did we go with? Stiff Records. And why did we go with them? For all the reasons that you just mentioned before, because they were credible, they were cool as F, and on top of that, they had all our mates on the label. So we said, yeah, we're going, you guys. Mm-hmm.
They wanted you to release singles, which were covers at the start, didn't they?
No, not at the start. We did a track called Hiawatha. Now that was, I think we did that because it had been a Body Snatchers track, because it was a reggae track. I really liked the track. I really did. I really liked it a lot. And I think Stella had written it, and she wanted it in there, and I wanted to do it. We all really liked it, and it didn't chart. And we had Alan Winstanley, Clive Langer, and Alan Winstanley. They were the producers of Madness at the time. So you would have thought it would have been a hit. And on top of that, we had Elvis Costello and Paul Young doing the backing vocals for us. Because you know, they're all, you see, that's another thing, Steve. When you're with Stiff Records, everybody knows each other and they're all cool people. And so you'll see somebody in the studio. And so the studio producers, who are good friends with these people, turn around and look, bang a couple of vocals on there for us, would you love? You know, all that kind of stuff, all to their buddies. And it would be too easy for them, you know. So So that's how that transpired. It was because we didn't we didn't I think we might have actually done another song as well, and then they decided we do a cover.
This band, because you know, if you look at a track like "Sign of the Times," it's really about it's a female empowerment song. This band was, in effect, way ahead of its time. You know, there were it was a girl band that had female empowerment 10 years before the Spice Girls, or even longer, maybe. But it's like it was a long time before that became a theme. And it was a, and I think there is a sort of argument to say that this was a really important band. Do you look back on that and realize how much influence this band had?
Well, there were bands before us.
Yes, there were. But I think this was one that was really, you know, a female empowerment band, a band that really you understood we were in a different era.
Right. Okay. Okay. I mean, because there was Fanny, remember, and there was the other one with my friend Cherry. She's a lovely girl, Cherry Curry, Runaways. So they were a girl band. Yeah, I mean, so that, but we were seven women, and they did six of them did play instruments, and we I suppose.
Okay, I'm going to put it this way.
It's a very strange thing you should say that, you know, Steve, because I'm working with a good friend of mine. If I'm just going to give you a story, because you ask great questions, by the way, and. And I'm working with a friend of mine, and I think that, you know, when you become older and you no longer do those kind of things. I mean, I still do music. I still go out. I record with absolutely everybody. I'm a prolific songwriter. But there comes a time when you go, you know, what else can I do with this that could be really good for somebody else? And I'm going out with my friend next year. She's a lady called Elizabeth Westwood. She's a good friend of mine, and she did that track Sonic Boom Boy. Anyway, we've become very, very good friends. We've got our own little radio show and everything else, and we're going out as a team of two ex-pop stars to educate women on what it was like back in those days, you know. So, and it was empowering, and all the hoops that you would get have to go around, because it was all kind of like very much a very male dominated world. And, you know, many of the people, it didn't happen to me because I could sing, but the others, the girls would be affected by, you know, the sound guy going, oh, she can't do this or she can't do this. Like, hold on a minute. You know, this is our gig, you know, and they were a bit flippant about the players. And I felt sorry for them in that way, the girls. So, but it was very, very self, you know, it was very empowering when you got through all of that and you got on top of the pops anyway, and you became that person that they didn't think that you could be, and you did it gracefully, and we had so much fun. I mean, it's some of the best years of my life. I can't you know, deny that.
I mean, I think what sums up what I wanted to say by that is that you wouldn't really imagine another girl group supporting the Clash.
Oh, the Clash. I mean, I'm doing something with Mick, actually, and some friends of ours, a play for next that comes out next year. Oh, that's something I'm up that we're doing. It's called Sticking Boy. Now that, well, I'll tell you that another time. But the Clash, that was something. That's funny enough. It was in Dingwalls that I found out that we'd be going to the Clash gig, and they'd asked for us. I didn't even know them, and they asked for us, and they said, well, we want the Bell Stars to come and support us. And so there were three bands out there. There was Telephone. Well, Telephone was the biggest. Do you know Telephone?
Yeah.
Well, Telephone was one of the biggest bands in France, and so they supported, and we were the main support. And then there was the Clash, and that was just one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life. And I remember us going from, I think we'd gone from Spain or something. We didn't have any time to wash our clothes. I had dirty knickers in a carrier bag. I kid you not. Like, this is the truth, right? Well, it's rock and roll, you know what I mean? I kid you not, no suitcase, nothing. Everything stinking. Anyway, so we get on the boat, and it's a boat, it's not even a plane. I don't know why. I think it's probably because of money problems and stuff. And we, and then we were doing, I remember us doing renditions of Aiko all the way from wherever we were, from England to wherever it was we get to the other side. And the captain, you know, he just said, yeah, we use our microphones, and we were singing renditions of like Aiko all the way through to the whole of the everybody on the ship. It was incredible. We arrived there, and then I just remember trying to get to sleep, and a good friend of Joe Strummer says, Jenny, well, I knew him, Cosmo Vinyl, Jenny, come on. I said, Jenny, come to bed. You know, I need some bed. And then my knickers were actually drying. They were drying in the sunlight. And I think, just put your jeans on, come on. So anyway, so I went down the stairs and they were all drinking and it was this and that. And then, so anyway, and that was just like, it was 5 days of that. And it was absolutely the best tour I've ever been on. The best. It was so much fun. They were such gentlemen. We had the best time.
What do you think bands like that, other artists, would learn from you at the time?
Mikey, that's a question. But you know, I haven't got an answer to that. For a change. I have to think about that one, Steve.
I've stumped you.
Listen, the day is not yet. I'm sure you've got a few more questions. I might come back with that answer. You never know.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
If I remember prior to that, my friend Tessa, she was in a band called The Slits, and they'd actually had them on their, on some of their tours back in those days. And so for us, I just wonder, you know, what it might be like for those guys to have the female artists on stage. And I remember what it was like for us. And, you know, Joe Strummer, I have to say, is just such a fabulous man. And I'll never forget him. And I remember walking in the first time I kind of really met him, and he said to me, now, Jenny, he said, I want to tell you something. He said, no drinking out of other people's cups. And I was like, well, why is that? And then he went down in this whole story, how he caught hepatitis and this and that. Well, I've never drunk out of anybody's cup since. And no, it's very, very true. And another thing was that back in those days, in France, well, I think we finished it in England, but in France, they were still spitting at the, you know, for the punk scene and all that spitting stuff. I was like, don't do that, man. It is just everybody spitting everything. And then, so Joe Strummer, guest on the first gig, he turned around and said, these are our guests. If anybody spits at this band, they said, they're women. They said, if anybody spits at this band, he said, we're not coming on stage. There wasn't one spit in the house for us. Jojo. But we just had such an amazing time with these people. They were so much fun. And there's so many funny things. I'm actually writing a book. It's called Do You Want to Hear a Story? And I've got stories about absolutely every single person that I've met on my musical journey. And the story about The Clash is definitely going to be in there. Mm.
Tell me one that I would not expect about someone that I would not expect.
Well, some personal ones I can't say. So
no, I don't mean that. I don't want to. I don't want gossip. Okay. I just want something.
Well, do you want a funny one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we're in the so we're in the coach, and we have to go through the checkpoint to because we're going to another country, right? And because we're doing the European tour, by the way. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, everybody stops and it's all right, and we're in this massive coach because we shared the coach together. That was their wish, not ours. But we were so grateful to them that we did. And then it was all quiet. I remember everybody being quiet. And then the guy that, you know, runs the coach, he thought, you know, we were sitting there waiting for a long time. Oh, I'll tidy up, right? So as he's tidying up around everything else, and then he picks up the bin to throw it out. And all of a sudden, you see a few people down from the back of the thing, no! And what's happened is they threw all their gear in the bin. They're smoking stuff. All the weed or whatever it is that they have. I don't even know how they got weed in the country. They're trying to stop. They were going ballistic. And I was laughing and crying. I don't smoke weed, but they did. And I just thought it was hilarious. I thought it was hilarious. That's just one of the funny moments. But there were more.
What has been your relationship with fame? Because, okay, I mean, fame is another thing where, you know, there are different massive different levels of it. And when I was on MTV, yeah, it was, you know, the attention at first was lovely and all that stuff, but I grew to look at fame as the reason that I wasn't happy. And I don't today, but I look at it because, you know, it's way in the past and everything, but that fame that I had then, I felt it was in the way of my happiness. And I just wondered if you saw fame in any different way than someone would normally describe it. Because people say, oh, it must be great to get attention. It must be great to be known. It must be great to have the door open for every nightclub, to be given whatever, which I was, and all that sort of stuff. But in the end, I saw it as something that actually was restrictive and wasn't a good thing, and actually probably the worst drug in the world.
Very interesting. It's very interesting how people see things differently depending on what their makeup is in life. I just went with the flow. I never, sometimes I would secretly, there'd be occasions where you'd be in certain situations where you'd secretly go, okay, I can get into that nightclub here and as I bring all my mates in and all the silly stuff. But, and yes, it does open doors. And yes, if you're in certain areas, people do seem to have this deep respect for, you know, they think that they have this respect for you for what they think that you've done and everything else. And you know that. And if you're an arsehole, you know, you'll play on that. You know, I never did. I had an experience once, and I share this with you. And I was doing Musikladen. It was a German radio show, just like Top of the Pops. And everybody was there. And one of the people that was there was Erta Kitt, right? And such a stunner. And I remember us all being in the refectory, you know, when they went up and did the camera stuff, that was one artist there, and all the other bands were in the refectory, we were like drinking wine, this, that, and the other. Then all of a sudden, and I'm playing backgammon with my buddies and stuff. And then all of a sudden, the door opens and it's like the OK Corral, right? So it's just like, you know, well, you know, in the Western where you see the door open and everybody looks around and everybody's quiet as a mouse, they zip the lip. And we're looking at, and it's her. And there's this tiny thing, right, with like high heels and this kind of fur she's got all over her. You know what she's like? Glamour puss, right? And she looks around the room and she's like, her eyes look over at the backgammon board and she's like, her darling, she says, who's winning? And I just said, I am. So she comes in, clack, 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 clack with her heels, right? And she gets her and she gets her on her hip. And she nudges me over and she says, right, I'm playing the winner. And I just thought, I want to be like that. I just want to be that kind of person. I never want to be up my own ass. I don't think I ever have been. And I just want to be just as cool as that woman is. And I wouldn't say I am cool, but I've never been up my own backside when it comes to that, even though I've seen an awful lot of my friends that have changed as a result of fame. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Eartha Kitt. I mean, Eartha Kitt, of course, famously stood up to Lyndon Johnson. She's stood up against racism in America. She stood for female empowerment before we were born. I mean, she was one of the most amazing women in the world.
Again, see, she had trauma in her own life. She's been through some stuff in her life, and that's why she was self-medicating too, because she drank quite a bit. But I just remember her. I remember saying to her, because my mother did actually really like her a lot, and I thought, oh, this is something I'm going to get. I'm going to get a picture of her, and pass it on to my mother. Even though my mother had done all those things, I still did that. And it was just a lovely thing, and it's just a memory that I have of this wonderful woman. I just really, really liked her, and I used to think, I know it sounds really childish and silly, but I used to think, oh, why wasn't she my mum? You know, and things like that. She was the most beautiful woman, and with the most down-to-earth, lovely soul.
When the band ended, and when that, for you, it sort of fell apart, and you went down a hole, you went down a, I don't know what you call it, really, like a, you went into a hole. Where was the moment? Because didn't you end up in Miami or in a clinic?
In fact, actually, I went to Carroll City or something. My family lived there, and then it was somewhere in America. And then I had a friend that was DJing out there, and he said to me, Jenny, don't go back home. You know, stick around, because I was only there for 3 weeks. And at that time, I was going out with my then boyfriend, Chrissy Boy from Madness, and who, by the way, I got off the phone with and said, Chrissy, that's the reason why I'm still wearing the hat. Anyway, so I was going out with him at the time, and I'd gone off to clean my act up, but I'd gone to my family. And then I was about to come home. 2 days before I came home, my friend picked me up in the car and said, Jen. And he brought me down to, what is it called? It's near Woody's nightclub, Miami, on Miami Beach. And I just thought, wow, what a beautiful place. You know, everything was 1930s buildings. It was just like really lovely. And I said, what a shame I didn't come here. It's really lovely. And he said, stick around, Jen. He said, just get a job, just stick around. And I was like, well, okay, let me see what I can do. So I stuck around, right? And I still had, you know, time on the visa and stuff. So, and then a year later, my boyfriend was so pissed off. By then, of course, I lost my boyfriend. And we were speaking about this on the phone earlier on today. But he's like my best friend now. Anyway, so cut a long story short, I'm out there and I'm doing shows, funny enough, with cassettes, because you could still do it in those days. It was like late 80s. And some of the things were the Bellstar stuff, which is like Ico and this and that, this and that. And there was this place called Scratch Nightclub that my friend DJed in. And all the pop stars would come. George Michael would come, this and that. And my friend at the time, Rusty Egan, he said to me, Jenny, he said, what are you doing here? And I just said, I'm living here. And he said, no. He said, everybody's looking for you. And I said, why, what happened? They said, you've got a hit. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And then the next thing you know, I hear that I'm in this. They've got a song in, what do you call it?
In Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman, Tom Cruise. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, and he said, can I take your number? I said, yeah, sure you can. So I gave him the number, didn't think anything of it. Now it's coming on Christmas, right? And it was only about a couple of weeks before that. And it's freezing cold. It was freezing, listen to me. Sorry, it was boiling hot. Sorry, because it was in Miami. It was boiling hot. And I was thinking, this is the weirdest Christmas I've ever had. I've never had Christmas in the heat and everything like this before. And we had the car radio. And I said to my friend, I really like this song. And she stopped in the middle of the freeway. What was you stretching? And I said, what are you doing? And she said, it's you. And I said, what's me? And I didn't realize it was me. It was my track because people were talking over it. And the people that were talking over it were Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman advertising the song. And they were using our song to advertise the bloody the film, which I'd never seen before. It was only just coming out. And I just thought, can they do that? Are they allowed to do that? Anyway, I get home, and a couple of days later, I get a phone call. Who is it? It's Hollywood. I kid you not. So this is what I'm saying about things dropping on my lap. It's just constant, man. And then, you know, in America, they deal with attorneys, right? I don't know what attorney is. So I knew there was an attorney next door. So I knocked on the door. I hardly knew the guy. And I said, excuse me. I said, I think his name is Joe. I said, excuse me. I said, I need an attorney. Now, he's come out of the door. He's only got a towel wrapped around his piece, right? And he's just like, kid you not, and I hardly knew him. And I said, I need an attorney now. He said, what's going on? I said, I've got Hollywood on the phone. He says, I'll be in 2 seconds. So the next thing you know, he's on the phone. 2 weeks later, I'm flying out to Hollywood. I'm chatting to all the executives, right? Just me on one side of the table and all of the executives on the other. And we're talking about how the video is going to be. And they said, you know, what have you thought about? And I was like, thinking, what the hell are they talking about? And then I said, why? They said, have you got an idea for the video? I was like, yeah, of course I have. I said, have you? I said, can I hear yours first, right? So I thought, so I said, no, I think I'll go with your idea. It sounds great. So the following day, there I am. What am I doing? I'm auditioning Janet Jackson's dancers, and the rest is history. 2 weeks later, it's on heavy rotation, and a video, and that was it.
It's just amazing. Eventually, you come back to England, and mm-hmm. and I hope I got the times right, because obviously there's, you know, in my head, it's I've read this and then I'm putting the times together. But you lived with a boyfriend. I think his name was Andrew.
Yeah.
And another tragic, terrible story. Can you tell me what happened?
Right, so he was in my friend. I told you my friend Gaz from way back in the day. Gaz Mayle was a good friend of mine at the time, and I played in his band. And we went to Japan together and everything else. And I got friendly with Andrew. He was the sweetest man, and he was very multi-talented. And he was highly intelligent, but he was very quiet, unlike me. Unlike me. And he just a lovely soul. And we got on really, really well. And unbeknownst to me, he had clinical depression. And there were no signs of it for me because I didn't understand it. So I wouldn't have known what to look for. Had I have met his mother, I would have known that. And he actually wanted me to meet his mum. But I still had reservations about meeting people's families because of my own mum. And so I chose not to do that. Anyway, cut long story short, one day, he moved in with me for a little while. And then one day I woke up and he was still lying there looking at the ceiling. And he did that for about 7 days. And I then just thought it must be me. It must be my fault. So I said to him, Andrew, I said, look, why don't you go back to your flat, you know, and see if, because I all the time I think it's my fault, all the time. And then he went back to his place in Cricklewood. And I was in Maidenvale at the time. And he then there was a knock on my door. Around near midnight one night. So this is about 7 days afterwards. And there was a police and they said, oh, you know, do you know Andrew? And I said, I do, you know, what's wrong? Is he okay? And they said, no, I'm sorry, but he took his own life. Well, you asked me a question earlier on and you know, I can't remember what it was, but this is the kind of answer to it. I can't remember how you put it, but in that moment, everything changed. And I screamed so loud, you must have been able to hear me in Australia. I couldn't believe it. And it was I don't know, it might have been some of the things that had hit me as a three-year-old, losing my sister. Remember, there was only two of us. When my sister's murdered, there's only me on my own, and I'm having to deal with a mother that I know what she's done, to my sister before I then leave the parental home. All of those things must come back into play when something like this happens. And you also then start to recognize and realize that this is way after, you know, Andrew died, that I've just been going on in life like a lost soul. I have been a lost soul nearly most of my life. At that age, I was 33 then. And realized then how lost I was. And eventually, I went down the road of Buddhism. I went to see my friends, and some of them were monks and nuns and all that kind of stuff. In fact, my friend was a nun, and she introduced me to all the others. And it was a great situation. It was really, really cool. But it took me a long while to get over that. I was so devastated. I was devastated, and it doesn't affect me anymore, but it was definitely the turning point that made me see things differently and start to become highly philosophical about life. And so if that was also a thing to do with the Buddhism that I'd encountered, I didn't go straight into Buddhism or anything like that. I observed it. And then I read its ways and stuff, and some of the stuff resonated with me. I wouldn't say I was a full-on Buddhist. I did take the vows and everything, all that kind of stuff. So at the time when I was in the environment, I did go all for it. But I've never been all for any religion, because it's not my way. Even though I do believe in something, a higher being. But that all came into play, and it made me realize the importance of life and how people are affected by when people go, you know, like that. And, you know, Andrew had everything to live for, but he himself had been traumatized as a child. And he once said to me, he said to me, Jenny, you're so much stronger than I ever will be. And I didn't understand it then, but he obviously knew. And some crazy stuff. It was devastating for me. Absolutely devastating.
I mean, when you say you'd be lying next to him at this period where he was just staring up at the ceiling, you know, for days, and you'd be going, "It's me," and
in my head.
Yeah, I understand. I understand that in your head, you know, you're thinking it's you.
Mm.
Was it? And this is terrible to ask in a way, is it something that when these events happen, you know, when your mother suffocated your sister and killed your sister, did you think it was you as well? Do you see what I mean? Were you to blame in your head for things that happened? And that was the key to change, was in a sense realizing that that wasn't the case. And then you can start to move on and heal.
No, when that happened with my mother, that I 100% categorically knew that it wasn't my own fault, because my mother was very cruel to me. I mean, she'd do horrible things, like remember the Alfred Hitchcock movies? I was terrified of them as a child, and she'd make sure she put the music on really loud, and I'd be absolutely screaming. Because for some reason I didn't like them, you know, well, possibly for good reason. So things like that. So no, I knew that was never about me, because I'd already had the experience of a woman that had been very cruel to me in the past. So from day one, my mother was quite jealous as well. You know, my father kind of at the time doted on me, and so she couldn't quite take that. So, but that's fine, you know. I understand now that my mother was damaged goods and the reasons why she did it, and I have no form of bitterness whatsoever. You know, in fact, I have a lot to thank her for. So if you see at the back of my book, I mentioned, I said thank you, you know, for basically giving me those lessons and making me the person that I am today. Because if it was not for her and her teachings or her abuse, I wouldn't be. I see them as teachings, Steve, you know. And now I'm able to turn around and say, you know, I see every single bruise as a blessing. You know, a blessing. It's like, the analogy is, you know, when you've got a butterfly, you know, you've got a caterpillar, and the caterpillar goes through that little pupae thing, and it goes through, and the struggle of life, and it's trying to get out. It's like, I'm gonna get out. And every time it bangs its little wing here and there, it gets a bruise on the wing until such time as it comes out of that thing. And what does it do? It spreads its wings, and all the bruises that you see are the colors that it's gained through its struggle in life. You know, and then that's the beauty that you can see in the butterfly. All you know, the beautiful colors, the struggles that it's had. And then all of a sudden it no longer has any struggles, and everybody sees it as a beautiful butterfly, you know? But the same with people. You know, it's what you do with the experiences of life that you have that will make you the butterfly that you become in the future, hopefully.
I think it's incredibly powerful what, you know, as I said at the start about the end of the book, and you saying that you thank your mother because those experiences of what, in essence, now has made you today who you are, having to go through all that. And that sentence, you chose your mother as a parent. I mean, it's an incredibly powerful sentence.
Would you like me to elaborate on that?
Yep.
I thought that was the question. Was it a question? Okay, well, you know, when you've gone through all this life and you've gone through all the traumas and you've come out the other side, and let's face it, you've had some good stuff too. I mean, come on, Steve, MTV. You know, who gets MTV slapped on them? Come on, that's an amazing thing. Who gets to become a pop star in their lifetime? That's an amazing thing. So we've got the balance here and everything else. But you become more philosophical about life with your observations and throughout all of your experiences. And then you get to a point and you realize and recognize that soon that life is going to be over with you in the flesh. And remember, I've also had a spiritual part in my life, very spiritual. So it would be starting off from, you know, them trying to indoctrinate me with, you know, the Catholicism. And then it's me going and finding my own way to heal myself through Buddhism because of a traumatic experience that I've collected within my journey. And then, you know, and then you have other traumas as well, you know. You know, one of them coming off the gear, one of them doing this, you know, my niece got, you know, stabbed to death in Camden Town. I mean, all of these things are traumatic, you know, but then you start realizing there's more to this. There's more to this. And I believe it's a very spiritual thing. And so I say, and so I search for things, and a lot of things make sense to me that the eye doesn't see. So I'm very much in the esoteric world from time to time, where people go, uh-oh, she's on one again. And so when you have that kind of meditative nature, you hear and see different things. And one of the things that makes sense to me is that I honestly believe that we have all known each other in planes before, in lifetimes before. I believe that this piece of skin here that you see is just a piece of meat, and that we were chosen to come down or to come up or wherever, or to be here on this plane in order to be able to witness something incredible, which I believe is going to happen this year, which is going to be biblical. And on top of that, it's to come again together. And how do I put this? We're all here for a purpose. Every single person that we see, good and bad. And we need, and we can't just have the good. We have to have the bad as well, because it's the bad that teaches us, you know? So like I say, my mother was a great example of that. You know, punching somebody in the face as a child is not a very nice thing to do. that isn't that kind of, you know, but at the same time, if that person can get through that and get out of that and then learn from it and then be able to teach somebody else the positives about that, then, hey, you know, so I would say, oh, and then we have to deal with karma, you know, because I believe in karma as well. And then I have to ask myself the question, what if I was my mother in another life? And if that was possible, then surely I should have some form of empathy. And that's when you start becoming even more, you know, with the empathy. And you start realizing that, you know, in the long run, it doesn't matter anymore. It's what you do with the experiences of life. And I realize and recognize, I believe, that I've known you in this lifetime, Steve, the people around me. I feel that we've all known each other and we've all come to a place where one day that we said that we would meet again. How do you know, Steve, that you didn't meet me in the thing before and said, Jen, you know, when you're 66, I'm going to come in, I'm going to ask you some questions because this, I'm in a position now to I've got a platform. And that platform, I'm going to invite you in there to talk about your life. And that might be able to help 5 people. It might be able to help 10 people. It might be able to help 1 person. But whatever it is it does, it is bigger than you, Steve. Because your platform goes out there and other people listen to it. And that will resonate. Something that I say will resonate with them. Because like you, many other people have been traumatized with something within their lifetime. I can guarantee. And I think that is our friendship on this plane. We've known each other before. I honestly believe that. We've been through some form of kind of parallel life where you've had a trauma. You've also worked in the music business. Come on, man. What's not to kind of say? There are no coincidences. There are none. I honestly believe that, Steve.
I think that's absolutely beautiful. And the thing is, this has transfixed me in the last hour completely. It's been fascinating. And what I love about your story is that it is such a tough story, but yet it's such a beautiful story in the end. And it's really powerful. And a friend of mine, and this is going to sound very facile, and she always says this to me, she said, let's face it, everyone's had a shit sandwich in their life, and it's what you do with it that counts.
She's totally right.
What you've done with it is fantastic.
No, she's totally right. It's a great way of, I might actually use it myself. No, she's totally right. And, you know, it's exactly what she says. You know, it's what you do with it.
That's it. Turn that shit sandwich into gold. That's what we need to do.
That's the one.
It's been amazing talking to you. I've loved every moment of it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Lovely thing. And thank you for thinking.
If we've met in a past life, I'm really happy about that.
Yeah.
Maybe we meet in the future life, this life. I hope so.
Yeah, well, hey, I hope this is not going to be the only time. You know, there are things that we all know. And in the future, like, I bet we will speak again. I know we will, Steve.
Brilliant. Okay, Jenny. Okay. Thank you so much. You can close the windows now, and I'm going to cook tea. Bye. Okay.
See you later.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews, and here is where you can connect.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.